Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are going to answer more of your coaching questions today. You can send them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast, and they can be related to cycling, triathlon, whatever it may be. And let's first start out with clarifying something. We had somebody.
Yeah, I was wrong.
Yes, Nate.
My sister is listening to this and going, yes.
So we were talking about caffeine last time, and from the context of it being a performance enhancing drug.
Yep. And I stated, I argue it still is a performance enhancing drug, but it used to be banned by WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, at high levels, but then the ban was lifted in 2004. And currently, it's on their monitoring list, or on their monitoring program. And that's kind of confusing. I looked to try to figure out what the monitoring program means. And it says, WADA, in consultation with signatories and governments, shall establish a monitoring program regarding substances which are not on the prohibited list, but which WADA wishes to monitor in order to detect patterns of misuse in the sport. Mm. So pretty much, I have my eyes on you.
Yeah.
But it's not... You can drink all the caffeine you want and not get popped for doping.
And maybe what they're doing is, from an optimistic perspective, perhaps just measuring that and then looking at any other type of increases or different markers. Maybe they're trying to understand how it affects you better. Who knows?
I think they're just, if they find, maybe they're still testing the levels, mm-hmm. you know, of that. Because if you see someone with like, I don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands of milligrams in their system, they might think it's ripe for abuse.
Right.
But so looking at this too, I read through the whole, the WADA PDF for what they, what's illegal to take. And I feel so bad for pro athletes because
even for us, anybody,
for pros, us too.
Yeah. For anybody that has a USAC or a USAT membership, you are agreeing to abide by these rules. And that means in and out of competition. So,
well, it depends. So looking at this list, there's a PDF. There are in-competition banned substances and then out of competition. So right. One example of that is, depending on the sport, is alcohol. As a cyclist, you can drink alcohol in competition if you want. But if you are a motorist, powerboat, archery,
I saw that.
Or like water sport, you can't drink in competition.
Yeah.
Sudafed, you can't have that in competition, but see, this is what gets me is that it says it is banned in competition higher than 150 micrograms per milliliter in your urine. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know how much Sudafed do I have to take it to cross that line, right? Yeah, that's the hard thing.
So if I'm like, if I have a race and I get sinus infections a lot and Sudafed, I think, helps relieve that symptom, I take 2 4-hour pills. Right, there's like a standard dose. Am I going to get popped for doping? Chad just shrugged his shoulders, like I don't know.
I have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're a pro, first you have to win. No, you don't. You don't have to win.
Randomly test.
Yeah, they got random testing.
And that's the thing.
I don't win Cat 5.
A lot of the time, we think that, and certainly you are more targeted if you win, right? In most cases, they tend to test the winner more than they'll just randomly test you if you're not even close to that. But even the guy that the tubby dude that's at the back of the pack, that's not even pack fodder, he's just fallen off the back of the pack. He still technically has to abide by the same rules as everybody else. So
not technically.
Yeah, he does.
You have to.
Yeah. So that's,
you can refuse the test, but you'll get sanctioned. So
that's like dope. I mean, it's the same thing.
It's admitting guilt almost. Yeah. I mean, it's not, but it equates to that because the ramifications are, you know, you're out for a couple of years.
Exactly.
The other one that was surprising is, so oxycodone is not okay out of competition. Hydrocodone is okay. My doctor always prescribes me hydrocodone, like it's a pain reliever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I think some people after surgery, you might get oxycodone.
Oxycodone after surgeries.
So I would love to interview some like a WADA official, if anyone knows one, or we go to a big race over there. Yeah, because my question would be, so if I get like an out of competition test and it's during a surgery or something like that, but you don't have a TUE before, because they're really big on that, right? You have to get the TUE before.
Beforehand.
So like I got my tonsils out, right? Do I have to go get a TUE before that?
And
if I'm like an age grouper, but now they're starting to, test age groupers. We had an age grouper get busted in Reno out of competition. like, how does that all work? And
yeah, like technically you'd have to talk to your doctor, understand what is going to be prescribed before the procedure, get the TUE before the procedure, have the procedure, then get the prescription. It's tricky.
A lot of people don't, probably a lot of people listening to the podcast know this, but a lot of, in the general population, they don't understand the difference between brand name and like chemical name. Mm-hmm. So you have to look up what the chemical name is, inside of this PDF, and you just search for things because you might, you know, or things have Sudafed in them. DayQuil doesn't anymore. They used to. Then they changed it to that other decongestion with a starts with a P also, but
right.
It's not the same get up and go that meth addicts use.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably why it's banned and high use because you can make meth out of it.
There's so many things on that list though, and if you look through it, and a lot of the time, especially when we're sick, where we tend to just take whatever we can get, you know, or whatever our doctor gives us, or, and it's, you should tell your doctor that you have to abide by this list and that you want to make sure that nothing goes against that. We have a doctor here in Reno that I use who's an avid cyclist, and he understands that. He's actually going to be really close to our new office too, so, which will be nice. But he understands that, and a couple times he's prescribed me things uniquely and mentioned the fact that since you're a cyclist, I'm going to prescribe this, or since you're an athlete, I'm going to prescribe this just in case. So that's,
oh, that, you know what though? I am looking at this too. I am going to correct myself again. The narcotics for like oxycodone, they are prohibited in competition only. So this is under, there's a section heading called substances and methods prohibited in competition.
That makes more sense.
And that is prohibited in competition, but it looks like you can take it. But see, I'm confused too, because it says cocaine is prohibited in competition, but I would think if you got caught with it out of competition, you would still get busted. But I guess according to this, you're not. This is all very confusing.
Yeah.
I wish there was they would turn this into a website or something too, so you could type it in and say, here's where it was good and here's where it
was
bad.
They have an app that you can type things into see. Yep.
Or just don't do drugs.
That's a good choice too.
I'm concerned about the things that, not that I'm doing cocaine a lot, but
just a little bit.
I tend to limit it to the off season.
Just a little bit.
I think everyone's fear, especially as CEO, I hope it's your fear too, Chad, our position in Trainer Road, that if we were to take something that we didn't know and we got caught doping, the backlash, it would be insane.
Which is,
like, people would just be like, they would hate you forever, Chad.
Yeah, and this is a conversation that we've had with, like, sponsoring athletes. You have no clue what athletes are putting into their bodies, and if you sponsor them, then you're associated with that. That can be tricky.
Yeah, I hope people understand that. As a brand, if when we support athletes like Justin Rossi, if we found out Justin Rossi doped, we would all be so. There's no, we don't think he does. If he did, like, we would be, we'd say, see you, Justin, bye bye. We'd cut all ties immediately.
Yeah,
but it would just be so unfortunate.
Zero tolerance.
Yeah, exactly. Zero tolerance.
Yeah.
That brings us to our next question.
Yeah, along the lines of banned substances, there's a guy wrote in with the name Mark DC420, and he says, "Hey guys, great podcast and app, longtime user and listener, first time caller. Piggybacking on all of the," and he says this in quotes, "but bro, I want to drink, get my party on and get fast too," questions from episodes 67 and 68. "What about the Mary Jane, Nevada, where Trainer Road's worldwide HQ and sprawling campus is based?" I like sprawling campus. That was very, that was very good.
Funny. We're like Google.
Yeah, exactly. "Just approved recreational marijuana, as have many other states. What is the coach's take on hippie lettuce, both pre, post, or during consumption?" I assume he means training there instead of consumption.
Well, two, this one, I'm looking it up, and marijuana, cannabis, you know, all some THC, prohibited in competition. We were talking about this before, and I didn't see that heading, is out of competition looks like it's not prohibited. But in certain sports, like we were talking about this before, the NFL, it's prohibited all the time.
Right.
And my personal stance on this,
UFC as well.
UFC, yep.
Yep. They've had a lot of guys pop for that in the past year, even in competition for that. So
I know this is a sensitive subject to a lot of people, but it will be legal in Nevada for recreational use January 1st. But in the NFL, Ricky Williams, he's a big proponent of marijuana use for pain management rather than taking opioids, which are in the same family as heroin. People get addicted to them. It can cause a lot of harm to your body.
Yep.
What he would say is, I would smoke weed and I would feel, I would have better pain relief and have less damage to my body.
Yep.
And in a very damaging sport. So for people of them, I feel sorry for them. I don't know. What do you guys think about in cycling? I was going to say, oh, it's banned, but it's only banned in competition.
Yeah. It's,
but I don't know what that means though. Does that mean, so, cause when you test for it, right? Uh-huh. Like it can show up in your body. Uh-huh. Many.
There's got to be a threshold.
A
designation. Yeah, exactly. A threshold.
Well, yeah. See, yeah, that's what, you know, like if you get like drug tested for a job, you can, if they do hair or whatever they do, it can be many, many months before.
Yeah. Trace amounts in that case.
Exactly. So in that situation, is it a urine test or is it a hair test, and how much, you know what I mean? So if you get tested at a world championships and you smoke some weed like 2 months ago and they do a hair test, mm-hmm. I'm guessing, I don't know my...
Yeah, we can only guess. I think we actually do need to interview a WADA official. Yeah. That would be awesome. Pretty informative.
Yeah,
yeah, because I would assume that it's...
taking hair. I think they're just taking blood and urine, right?
I don't think it's ever anything.
So it's really only a couple days then probably for
the urine. Too, yeah.
Is it urine? I don't know. Yeah, I've been tested, so...
I've never tried to like get around a drug test, so I don't know.
My performances are so incredible. They're always trying to test me. I'm joking. So I looked into this a bit and found some pros and cons, just some layman's pros and cons from this. Keep in mind that there are different ways to ingest or to consume marijuana. There's
pros and cons of what?
Of marijuana on performance of athletes, right?
Like for recovery?
Yeah, and just in general.
And before you get into all of this, this is one of those things, too, where there is not a ton of research because it was illegal before.
No, I was going to bring that up.
Hopefully there's more research coming out.
I dug into PubMed to find some, you know, some well-formulated studies, and everything is 2016. I couldn't find anything earlier in 2016.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah, so
which makes sense that right now it would be coming out more research on it since it's more of a topical thing.
I just saw an anecdotal video. I mean, video about Parkinson's. There's so much of people say it'll cure everything. You know what I mean? But hopefully they research it and we'll get some hard science. But
right.
So is it what you're saying, hard science, Jonathan?
No. Well, Chad will be
or
able
is this
to,
people's
to,
anecdotes?
Mine that they, is. Mine
a lot of these are based off of the anecdotes. Yeah. And I think that this is going to be good to compare that to more the fact-based stuff with Chad. So on the pro side of things, it decreases anxiety. It reportedly decreases anxiety. Now, this is interesting, though, because it has different effects on different people and there are different mm-hmm. strains of yeah, cannabis. That's... And some people report that it decreases anxiety. Others report that it increases. Yeah. So reduced inflammation is one that's reported as a general benefit. Increased oxygenation of tissue is one that I read, and I'm not sure. That one definitely should be studied, because if that's the case...
Well, one thing too, smoking cigarettes increases your hematocrit. Huh. Yeah, it raises your hematocrit in your blood, and... But it's the negative parts of it makes it so it's not a performance, is not performance enhancing because of the downfalls of it.
Mm-hmm. On the con side of things, decreases mental acuity. That's been, that's also gone both ways.
Pretty substantiated.
So that's very, right
well,
there.
Well, it's still anecdotal, right? Like exactly. You just think that.
And that's like when we think of somebody that smokes marijuana or consumes marijuana. And
they call it marijuana.
We think of, I'm trying to.
All the Mormon in
he
you.
Called it, he called it hippie
marijuana
lettuce.
Cigarettes.
Yeah, Mark called it hippie lettuce. He called it everything else. And we're talking about this, how it's funny that people that smoke weed, they never just call it weed. They always have, like, they have to bring it up five times in a sentence, it's got a different name every time. So I'll just stick to marijuana. Chad will get more technical with the terms, I'm sure, coming up. But
I don't plan to, no.
Okay. So the mental acuity thing, that goes both ways, too, because the stereotype is somebody sitting on the couch and just, like, drenched in Doritos and Coke, and they're just hanging out. Coca-Cola, I should clarify here. But just hanging out and just vegging, right? But that's not necessarily the case. So that's definitely the stereotype.
Which also, though, that could be a benefit. My wife's on her taper week right now, and I'm like, sit down, you rest.
Could, yeah, exactly. And that's one thing to bring up. I saw a lot of anecdotes from athletes saying that after I come home from my workout, I smoke, or they take an edible or whatever else, or they vape. And at that point, they're like, and I can recover so much better. And I'm thinking, like, it's just because you're, you know, that makes you just want to chill on the couch, because that's going to be better recovery than walking around, you know? So that's kind of the.
Yeah, I'd like to see a study where some people did it and some people didn't, but they both just laid down.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. That would
and
be
ate
interesting.
Some food.
It's kind of like those compression boots or like the stim units
that
you put on
lay
to
down
recover.
For an hour.
You got to lay down. So, of course, it's going to be good, you know? Then elevated heart rate is one that's a con that they say, but that is seems to only appear with smoking, but I'm not sure. That's what it was indicated by the articles that I read from Men's Fitness, Business Insider, from a few different resources like that. And respiratory issues, if smoked, clearly there are issues that come along with that that are proven that inhaling smoke obviously is going to cause respiratory issues. So those are the basic list of pros and cons. But Chad, do you want to share some info you found?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to keep it more how it relates to performance. And let's be clear, there's nothing to further the notion that marijuana is in any way performance enhancing. So that's really the gist of it. Yeah, anti-inflammatory effects, that's kind of their flagship aspect of it, in that it's an alternative to like NSAIDs. And you know, whereas the, you know, or aspirin and ibuprofen, that sort of thing, takes particular types of tolls, you know, on your liver in particular, that's said to not be the case with marijuana. So that's one thing that weighs in its favor, not necessarily a performance enhancing one. On the enhance performance,
but before you go any farther than that, one thing that WADA does, and I've heard dopers use as an excuse, is the performance enhancing, like where that line gets drawn, because a lot of, like, I heard there was a guy a couple years ago, he was a master's athlete, and he got busted for doping, and he was doing testosterone, and this is what his doctor prescribed. And his argument was, hey, if I start a race and I inject testosterone in me, I won't have enhanced performance. So it's not performance enhancing, therefore it shouldn't be banned. But the other side of that is, it allows you to train more and recover faster for the other, you know, 51 weeks out of the year.
Exactly.
Therefore, it's performance enhancing and busted. So
yeah,
when Chad says performance enhancing, I think you're saying, if I smoke weed before I do my,
it's not going to make you ride your bike faster.
Yeah. My 2x20.
Yeah.
It's, I'm not going to go any faster.
Yep.
But I think what Water's point will probably be is that you will recover better. Is that, that's what they're thinking? I'm assuming. Again, it would be great to have someone on there.
Yeah, it's a pain management thing, and pain management ranges from very legal to very illegal. So
yeah, but now that it's legal, like,
could be that.
I mean, if it became nationally legal, would they consider, because like they don't make ibuprofen illegal, right?
Yeah.
And you could, I mean, but ibuprofen, actually don't take ibuprofen to prevent, that could actually hurt your gains too.
Yeah.
Like that's, it's another, it's a side note. But, sorry, so continue, Chad.
Well, the two things I found most interesting was that one study talked about the deleterious effects to lung function and respiratory pathogen clearance. So, you know, if you're getting sick, you got something going on upper respiratory, probably not a good idea to hit the pipe. So that kind of is just common sense. Not surely anybody needs to be told that. But what was interesting is they talk about, you know, the lung downside. There was also a measured increase in forced vital capacity. And I don't know if you guys remember way back, we talked about vital capacity versus tidal volume. Vital capacity being the max amount of air you can push after a max inhalation, how much you can exhale, whereas tidal volume is more normal breathing. But it actually improved it. And they attributed that to, once again, its anti-inflammatory effects. In this case, the bronchodilation. So your bronchioles open up, you can push more air.
But that would only help. So that's one thing that that would only help if you were restricted by that, right? So if you
couldn't get enough air in
because
that's a great point. That's rarely a bottleneck for somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Like your body can only absorb so much oxygen. So
and that's it. So again, it's not performance enhancing. Interesting, enhancing. No,
I want to hit this point a little bit harder before we move on. That's because there's some products that say, I will, you know, expand your, it'll help you expand your lungs so you can breathe more
like
air.
Like those masks that you put on that limit that, and it's supposed to strengthen things.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I used to play tuba in college. I was a music major and for a little bit of college. And boy, I swam and I did tuba. Talk about a huge lung capacity, but that didn't raise my VO2 max.
Well, and how long lasting is this bronchodilation anyways?
That's a good point.
But but even if it is, so what? So if I can get 2 times the amount of oxygen in my lungs, doesn't mean that I'm absorbing more oxygen.
No, we expel so much of the oxygen that comes into the system right back out.
Yes. It's like dropping it into a very small strainer, right? Yep. You can put as much as you want.
It's not a percentage base either. Not like if I can only absorb 50% of my lungs and I can now take in 10 times more, that I'm going to have 10 times more.
You can increase that absorption, but it's still, you're still not going to process every bit of oxygen that comes into your lungs or into your bloodstream.
Be more fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so the one downside, and this is an important one, so this is an actual performance limiter, is that it decreases calcium sensitivity. So if you're familiar with what goes on at the, you know, muscle fiber level or at the filament level with the actin myosin, those calcium channels are a big player in actual muscle contraction. So if you reduce that sensitivity to those calcium or those calcium channels, it actually causes muscle weakness, true muscle weakness. You're not able to recruit the muscles in the same way. So this would probably be the one study I found that clearly says absolutely no, not only are there no performance benefits, but there's actually a performance detriment.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to keep our, as more studies come out with this, maybe we'll see something that's a little more solid.
But again, you know, this is like, we're saying you wouldn't want to smoke marijuana and then hop on the bike and expect an improved performance because of maybe the anti-inflammation or the pain, right, the pain reduction. The fact is that's negated by what it does at the muscular level.
There we are. Interesting.
It'll be, I think you're about to say, we'll keep looking at this, and hopefully in the next few years,
oh, yeah, I imagine even, a lot of studies are going to keep cropping up.
And it's going to, this is going to be tough because there are people who don't want it to succeed.
Yes.
And there are people that very much want it to succeed.
So these studies will be very much skewed.
Not necessarily. It matters who does it, right? There are scientists out there that don't care either way.
Yeah.
They just want the truth.
Scientists.
Hopefully. Scientists, yep.
Yeah, scientists instead of businessmen. So let's go into Oboe's question from Twitter. He says, sorry if this is a stupid question. It's not, Oboe.
It's
that's,
okay.
That's
there
why
are no
I
stupid questions,
it.
Only stupid people, Oboe. And I'm not implying you're stupid.
Oh, geez.
This one's good. You say, does taking a gel during sweet spot base
that's a great question.
Affect aerobic fitness? So, and we could probably detach this from sweet spot base. We're just talking about...
Workouts period,
yeah.
Yeah, so aerobic fitness, no. Aerobic adaptation, perhaps. So anytime you introduce sugar into the system, your metabolism shifts to metabolizing that sugar, which is an anaerobic process. So for a little while, you're going to kind of veer off that aerobic adaptation course. Mm. By, once again, introducing sugar into the system. If you don't need the sugar, don't add it. Make your body learn to metabolize fat. You've got plenty of sugar stored in the muscles themselves. A little bit will come from the liver, a little bit. In any case, you probably don't need it. If you find that you're fading in a workout, longer workout, then, you know, use it. But I see too many people who have hour-long workouts, even 90-minute workouts, where they're just dosing themselves every 10, 15 minutes, just, you know, a couple gulps of Gatorade or taking a gel. And the fact of the matter is, most of the time, you don't actually need that exogenous
carbohydrate. I've got a question for you then. Hmm. I've been thinking about this a lot. What if I'm an Ironman guy, mm-hmm, and I'm doing two workouts a day, and I know that during my Ironman, I'm going to have to take sugar, right?
Yep.
And there's some people in this room named Jonathan Lee who has a weak stomach, right?
Really weak.
Yeah.
So
these are both cases for why you would do something like this. Over the course of an hour-long workout, I don't think that's a time to practice your nutrition. Mm. That's something you'd say for the longer workouts. And then what was your other?
Well, I was thinking, like, what if you do it, if you have... So what I'm getting for is, let's say I do all my stuff under 2 hours with no sugar,
mm-hmm, right?
And then I only do it on the longer stuff. Am I getting like, could I be better if I took that sugar on the shorter ones too?
Could your performance be better or your tolerance of the food?
Tolerance for food.
Okay. Yeah. For that specific food.
I don't know. I mean, you're going to train. What you're describing sounds like higher intensity workouts. So the ingestion of this extra sugar during high intensity versus what you're going to do over a longer, slower effort, don't really compare.
Gotcha. Exactly. Yep. You're right. Because at higher intensity, you take sugar and it's a lot. Unless it's like Gatorade or something.
The likelihood of GI distress is much higher when you're already gassed and you're not getting a whole lot of blood flow to your gut.
My second one, and we've talked about this, about recovery shakes and stuff, and after 24 hours, it kind of comes back. But there is a point if you're doing multiple workouts in a day.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you have to keep your glycogen topped off for a second workout in the day, later in the day, and you're not trying to do that workout in a depleted state, then it's a high consequence.
I would, when I was doing Ironman stuff too, I'd swim like 90 minutes in the morning, mm-hmm, and I'd drink Gatorade the whole time. 7 mile run at lunch, and I wouldn't have anything during that. And then afterwards, I'd go climb Geiger, and that's like another 90-minute ride that's fairly intensive. But out of all that, you have to eat a lot. And top your glycogen out.
Yeah, and I don't like the idea of topping it off with those particular forms of carbohydrate, but you know, that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah.
Let's go into Klaus's question, also from Twitter. And you can use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad on Twitter, and then we come through those questions each week. He says, when doing mostly zone 2 endurance training, is it best not to mix it up with intervals for the best adaptation? I assume what he means by intervals is higher intensity.
Yeah. So you'd have to, you know, consider what you're after with that particular session. If you're looking for a long session and you blow yourself up with the addition of intervals and what was supposed to be a 4-hour ride becomes a 2-hour ride because you cooked yourself, then, you know, probably not a great idea. But if you're trying to, you know, prepare yourself, maybe maximize the neuromuscular contribution and do a few to kick things off, maybe deplete a little bit of your anaerobic or your sugar stores prior to the rest of the long Z2 work, that has its place. Throwing in some at the end of a workout to see that, you know, to basically practice for sprinting at the end of a long effort, that has, you know, its place as well. So it is going to be based on what you're after with that workout.
I've noticed too that like Pettit and even some, this is way before I even met you, Chad, as I was doing a Hunter Allen plan and he had some called form sprints inside of a long Z2 workout.
Yeah.
So what are those, why are those in there? What place do they have?
Some of it, like I just said, is about burning off some of your anaerobic stores. Mm-hmm. So getting rid of the sugar and fatiguing muscles that pack a lot of sugar. So
and,
they,
and these are like 15 seconds.
Yeah.
10, 15 second kind of
and,
out of
and
the sprint.
Just waking up muscle fibers, trying to improve the amount of muscles you can recruit when efforts like these crop up. Mm-hmm. So basically neuromuscular communication, establishing greater lines of communication or stronger lines between muscles that ordinarily wouldn't get taxed, wouldn't get utilized. So you're basically just adding more potential.
You're saying, wake up legs.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
You're going to all work, not just a little bit of you.
This is a good question because I've ridden with a lot of people, especially during fall, winter months when you're riding with them and they say, no, I can't break zone two. I've got to stay within it. And they think that if they've gone above and then they drop back down, that they've nullified all that work that they've done. But you said something that's really key, Chad. If those efforts have reduced your capacity to actually fulfill the workout and not allowed you to ride that 4 hours.
That's when it becomes
the
greatest concern. Yeah. I mean, that's just like any group ride that turns into a pissing match. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going out for a 4-hour ride today. Nobody
goes
hard.
Group ride?
Yeah. Oh, I do. Yeah. I mean, and by group, I mean more than one rider.
Yeah. That's all you need. Yeah. That's all you need.
Me and my wife go at it.
Yeah. I think Strava counts in that too. If it's just you and you're riding
you and
against that's plenty of people that you're riding against.
I have a question. Yeah. I've been thinking about this too. How does slow cadence, well, what are your thoughts on this, Chad? Slow cadence work and bigger muscles in the legs. Like, so I have kind of skinny cycling legs. I know some people do. You got giant cycling legs. There's a picture of you on
they're giant, but
on Facebook. You can see Coach Chad and someone talk about how buff you are.
Yeah.
Which you need to do. You need to lose weight, though, if you want to get good at cycling.
And we're not saying fat. Chad's lean.
Yeah, so, no, lean, but... I've noticed, so I've kind of been more towards 100 RPM. Mm-hmm. As I go to 90 and 80, I can feel it more in my legs. I don't know if it's really going to...
You can feel it more,
gonna,
but does, you know, does
gonna,
that actually result in hypertrophy of muscle fibers? Do your legs actually blow up? Do they get bigger? And so much of that is based on your personal physiology, your limb length. I mean...
That's what I was going to say. It's all genetics. It seems like...
You can affect it to some extent, but not as much as most people want to.
Genetics,
I mean,
or steroids.
You can't... Yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's not get into that.
I'm looking at... there's some pictures of people on the wall in Chad's office behind him, and I'm looking at a 90 cyclist.
He's
got the biggest legs.
Yeah.
Well, the guys who go fast typically have a fair amount of muscle on their.
Yeah, but like Chris Froome doesn't have.
Not all of them. Yeah.
Fabian Cancellara has. I said his name wrong.
But tree stumps.
Yeah, tree stumps, and then Chris Froome, not tree stumps.
Yeah, but asking Cancellara to get down to stick thinness, wafiness is basically impossible. Asking Chris Froome to bulk up to something like Cancellara's, you know, leg size is impossible. Well, so there are genetic limitations.
So that's what I was thinking. It's mostly genetics, the size of your legs.
I can't say for sure whether it's mostly, but that's a massive component.
Yeah, look at Chris Horner, for example. Chris Horner doesn't spin an overly quick gear. He, in fact,
and that's
spends
the other thing.
A huge
just because
amount of
you
time.
Train at low cadence doesn't mean you're going to have big muscles. Just because you train at high cadence doesn't mean you're going to shed some of that muscle fiber necessarily.
Yeah. He
that
spends,
is what I wanted the info. Thank you, Chad.
He spends the majority of the time out of the saddle. Horner, oh, I should say did. I guess does. He's still kind of going. But and he has, I would say, dainty legs. They're extremely skinny. So, yeah, it all changes.
Lance had pretty big legs, but...
He's a big guy.
Pharmaceuticals, though, too.
Yeah, the fiber type composition. So, you know, your slow twitch fibers, your fast twitch fibers, and how they react to exercise and different types of exercises. Pretty much genetically predetermined. You can sway a little bit of the intermediate fibers, but for the most part, you got what you got.
Let's move on to Rick's question. He says, hey guys, long-term listener, recent training plan user. I've loved the podcast. 5 stars. Thanks for the stars.
Thank you.
We'll take them. And find the back catalog a fantastic resource for most of the questions I've had. However, I haven't seen any discussion on this burning issue. Burning. Whose voice should I have in my head reading out the instructions on the workouts? Is it Chad or Jonathan?
Well, Rick, you can choose whichever voice you'd like to hear, but I write all those. So those are, a lot of them come from when
who are you?
I'm Coach Chad.
There you go.
Oh yeah. So Coach Chad. I had a few training centers and I led the classes and, basically if you want to put a voice in your head, it's mine. And it's probably a pretty stern one most of the time, because when I said most of this stuff and when I write most of this stuff, I'm hearkening back to the days where I was on the trainer with 7 other people gutting it out with them. So,
yeah.
And I would find myself at different points in the workout pausing and telling people, I'm sorry I sound so stern. I'm sorry I sound so angry. But the fact is, you need, a firm hand to guide you in situations like these. But also, I'm doing this workout with you and I'm in quite a lot of pain. So it's hard to manage that and be friendly over the course of it.
And be honest, is there any self-talk that isn't a little stern during the workout?
Gotta be.
Are you ever like, great job, you can take it easy?
You're doing so well, buddy. Keep it up.
Yeah. You're, nah.
I hear Morgan Freeman.
Push it.
Yeah, that's a good
idea. Fatherly yet stern. I'd listen to him.
Yeah. And to give you some insight, I tried to help writing some workout texts before and it was terrible. So Chad redid it.
It just didn't jibe with the rest of
it. Wasn't good.
What we had going on.
Chad knows what he's doing with that. So, that's a big deal there. So let's move on to Callum's question. He says, hey guys, great job on the podcast. Only discovered it a month or so ago, but working my way through the archive, I recently started Sweet Spot Base Low Volume 1. Once again, that's one of our base phase training plans as I build towards the 2017 Great Britain triathlon season. I assume that's what he means by GB. I could be incorrect. Sorry, Callum, if so. However, with a young family, it's sometimes difficult to fit in the full volume with swim and run training as well. I can usually manage the 2-hour long workouts, but I've been splitting the longer weekend ride into 2 45-minute efforts with the same cumulative TSS. Does this sound like a good option, or would I be better substituting for a single higher TSS ride? Do you want to go there, Chad, or do you want me to keep going into the next point?
These look like two different questions.
Let's hit that.
So splitting workouts, especially workouts that short, it's not to say you won't derive some benefit, but the fact is what we're after is overload. So 2 45-minute workouts may not achieve the same level of overload that a 90-minute workout does. So you may be doing 2 fresh workouts and reaping the benefit that goes along with being fresh for workouts like that, but the workouts might not be challenging enough over a duration that short to make them as worthwhile as they'd be put together. So it's not worthless training, not at all, but it might not be quite as effective as it could be if you did them both together.
And one thing that we are looking at right now is Chad's reviewing all the plans, and we've had many internal discussions here. Some of the plans, they have some really long
indoor endurance rides.
Yeah, that are
65%-ish sort of stuff.
Yeah, 2-3 hours, 3.5 hours. I think there's even a 4-hour one in there.
There's a 5-hour one in there.
Yeah, and we all talked to each other, and we looked at some of the numbers, and those ones just don't get done indoors. A lot of people skip them.
Yep.
It's different if you're an Ironman athlete, but for most racers. So what we're looking at is to change the messaging on that is either do them outside, and then we're thinking about switching some of those out with sweet spot work.
Yeah, basically sweet TSS. Spot alternatives. So if you're going to do it inside and you don't feel like being on the bike for multiple hours, especially at a low intensity like that, which is basically the only way you're going to do multiple hours, then we're going to offer a sweet spot alternative, which, conveys a lot of the same benefit, comes at a little bit of a higher physiological cost, but it's less time. The two should equate roughly, not exactly in terms of adaptation, but close enough for what most of us are after.
Yeah, and it's better to do it than to skip it.
Yes.
Because it can be so
absolutely.
Hard, even for... So, CEO of Trainer Road. Those are hard for me. It's like it takes up a lot of the weekend just to do it like that.
I admire the people who can get on there and do 3, 4, even 5 hours. I've seen some of the, I think it's Ptarmigan or something. Some people have actually gotten through it. It's amazing to me.
My wife has done it.
Very, very dedicated.
Impressed.
They have goals and they're intent on achieving those goals. So impressive for sure. But speaking from experience, I can't make myself stay on there for longer than 2 hours.
One thing to clarify here though, Chad, because we just said if you're splitting up a workout that's 90 minutes long into something smaller, and then you're just trying to match the TSS, that's not what we're doing in this case either. What you're still going to experience overload with these workouts if you were to substitute them with a sweet spot one. It's not going to be a 45 minute workout.
Basically, we're just trying to make your time worthwhile. We don't want you skipping that workout, so we're going to offer an alternative that's a little less time consuming,
probably something around 90 minutes benefit. Or so.
Well, it depends. It's going to be TSS driven based on, like, you know, if it's a 4-hour ride, it's got to be more TSS than if it's a 90 minute ride.
Certainly.
But we think too that 90 minutes is probably the cutoff for it's endurance stuff.
Doable.
And then up in volumes, we're probably going to get up to 2 hours of sweet spot work, which means you're doing a lot of 2x20s, which is still a great workout.
Totally doable too, with 2 hours.
I have like this thing in my head.
20 minute intervals.
2 hours I can do. 2 hours is like, oh, I got a really good workout. That was amazing. And I can watch a movie during those 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Over 2 hours, there's like mentally something that's harder for me to do.
Yeah, and I think most just people, given the alternative, are going to save those rides for outdoors. Yeah. So we're just trying to keep in mind that some people are going to be trapped indoors and they don't want to do a 4 or 5 hour ride. So what's the alternative?
We just want to get...
indoors, Chad.
Well, if the weather's terrible and they can't go outside, they don't have that option.
I guess that's the right one. Yeah. So we just want to say, like, we're all about structure training, and a lot of people have wrongly accused us of saying never go outside or something like that.
Oh, no.
We all race outside. Exactly. We ride outside.
And we just want to make you faster.
This is part of our training. Yeah,
and
exactly.
And if you do the workouts, you'll be getting faster. But if you skip them, then you're missing out. So
physiologically, though, if you do, I mean, 4 hours on the trainer without stopping pedaling.
Huge benefit.
Outside, it's not going to be the same. But again, it's about one, there's got to be some enjoyment in your training. And if you dread 4 hours on the trainer, it's just you're not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And if we can reduce that time and you can get most of the same benefit, that's good too.
If you're motivated by those long rides, you can do those
them.
Too.
You do them too.
Absolutely. We're not trying to talk you out of doing those long rides.
Yep, there's some people, there's a guy who works for us named Adam Salvo. He might be listening to this, but
half robot. Yeah.
He's an outstanding triathlete. I think he does like a 420 or 430 half Ironman. Very fast. But he just, I will do it. He'll just get on and do it.
Yeah. Yeah. He's super diligent. So let's move on to Josh's question. He says, "Hey, Trainer Rhoda, I have a question that I don't believe has ever been addressed in the podcast before. For 2016, I think there are a lot of questions that haven't been addressed. So for 2016, I use an old beater bike with virtual power for my Trainer Road training. And for those that don't know virtual power, it's basically something that we have. If you don't have a power meter, but you want to train with power, you just hook up a speed sensor, tell us what trainer you're on, and then we estimate your power for you. So that's what he's using. It's a whole lot cheaper than a power meter, and you still get the benefits. So he says that he's using virtual power on Trainer Road and struggled with the 11:28 rear cassette at times. It left me between gears such that I had to spin at a cadence slightly below or above where I typically work best. My ideal cadence to work is 95 to 100 RPM, and I'd often find myself having to push 85 to 90 RPM or 105 plus RPM just to meet the target power goals for certain workouts. And this is topical because pretty much I looked at pretty much every new bike, it seems, comes with at least an 11:28 and some 11:32. So it's pretty common scenario that people have. And they're, most of them are 11 speed. For my winter training, I decided to get a power meter as well as a spare wheel and an 11:23 cassette for my nice bike to hopefully eliminate this issue of being between gears. The nice bike has a different chainring setup of 50-34. Those are compact chainrings on the nice bike versus on his old school bike, he had 50-39-30 triple on the front there. A tighter cassette in the rear definitely helps, but unfortunately now I'm cross-training to meet my target power goals to meet my target power goals right around sweet spot and threshold efforts. Any tips or advice? This has become an extremely frustrating problem for me, leading to me feel like the only solution is to get a Wahoo kicker that will adjust. That's convenient.
<I'll> do it.
That will adjust resistance to match my target power goals, no matter what gear I'm in, so that I can finally work inside my ideal cadence range.
This is a really good question because I was just doing the chimney, and the workout text in that is all about you're not always going to be riding at your ideal cadence.
Mm-hmm.
Like the race will dictate it.
Yeah.
Totally true. And I think about situations where there are wind, that when you're coming against wind, or it's rolling hills, or you have a pack that's surging, or anything. Pack riding will force you into situations that you can't decide
I'm between gears.
let's ease it up just a little bit. Too much, yeah. I'm out of my range again, you know? We're not making fun of you here, Josh, at all.
But Chad, is there something to be said about practicing being able to ride
absolutely
at a large range of cadences?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, that's hugely important. I mean, if you have the luxury of being a steady state athlete, where on a dead flat course and you get to pick that perfect gear and it lands right at the watts you're trying to hold, well, that's good fortune. Plain
and
simple.
You don't have to deal with wind.
Yeah. We're always changing. That's why half the cadence drills worm their way into these workouts, because I want people to be familiar with pushing different gear ratios at different intensity levels. It's a necessary thing. Sure, gravitate toward what works best for you. Apply that in a race scenario if you can, but it's not an all the time occurrence.
On the chimney, you start off with 30 seconds of anaerobic. It's very
gear.
Yeah, it's big gear. But I went down on the kicker down to like 50, 60 RPM.
Yeah,
and you start that, and it's like, oh, I'm in the wrong gear starting
this
climb.
That's strength, basically. That's hitting those fibers we were talking about earlier with those little sprints that you sprinkle in those long endurance rides.
Yeah. And then at the end of that 30 seconds, I wound it up to 90 RPM. And then after that, you have like, I think, 3 minutes at a little bit below FTP. But then I would, one interval, I would hit it at 100. One interval, I hit it at 90. Another interval, I hit it at 80. And mm-hmm. just kind of play around with the different cadences.
It's awesome. Yeah. That's the way to do it. And as a mountain biker, we're forced all the time outside of our cadence ranges.
We're just talking about flat roads and steady state athletes, mountain biking, criterium riding. Yeah. I mean, cyclocross, your cadences are all over
even,
the board.
Yeah. Even on a TT, like if you're a triathlete, you'd be lucky if mm-hmm. it's not that you say, oh, I'm going to ride at this power, because you might be, your power target might be 225, mm-hmm. but because of the road and your gearing, that might be at 90 RPM when you're ideal is 95, but don't even think about that close. Just train to be able to be in multiple areas. So Josh, I would say this is look at it as a benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
And unless you're putting out really big watts, I wouldn't worry too much about cross training, especially cross chaining. Sorry. Especially for, you know, short interval type workouts where you're not on there for hours on end. Your gears are a lot tougher than you're giving them credit for.
Totally. And cross chaining is something that, once you get a one by drive train, you'll get over pretty quick.
Yeah, what is cross chaining for newbies?
So cross chaining, essentially, if you are in your big gear up front, so you're all the way to rider's right in the front with the chain, and then you're in your small gear, your lowest gear on the back, which happens to be your biggest one, so all the way to the left, your chain is not straight, it's crossed up, right?
Yeah, so if you look down and there's a sharp angle from your cranks back to your cog's head or your wheel, that's cross chaining.
And he means that angle from that the chain is making, that line that the chain is making.
You'll get some rub sometimes, right?
You'll get derailleur rub, you get less efficiency in your drivetrain as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit more resistance, right?
Yeah, yeah. And
Friction Fracs has a, we talked about Friction Facts before, but they have something about cross chaining, and it's not that many.
It's not as much as people think. And
also, your chain better.
A lot of people, there's kind of like a Voluminati thing with this, with the whole, you know, a noob would cross chain, but pros never cross chain. And to be honest, once everybody's on a one by drive train, which probably won't ever happen with road, but when you're on a one by drive train, you cross train all the time.
I affected a one by drive train at Nevada City, which is a very hilly course. Mm-hmm. Just left it in my big ring the whole time and was all over that cog set.
And it worked just fine.
No problems at all.
Yeah. So I don't think that cross chaining is as bad as people make it out to be. If you're constantly, if you've never shifted your bike out of the little ring or the big ring and you're constantly running that, then yeah, you'll wear down one more than another. That might be an issue. But it also, like, breaking a chain because you're cross chaining, I've heard people say that's ridiculous. You'd have to have a totally worn out chain
again,
and drive
this equipment is much stronger than most people give it credit for.
Yeah.
One thing to keep in mind when you are cross chaining, if you're in the big ring on the front and you're in the littlest in the back, and then you dump to the littlest in the front,
drop your chain,
there is a greater chance, depending on how your stuff is tuned, that you could drop your chain.
Yeah, right? Basically, if you make a front chain ring shift, a big one, or just if you have a 2x or a 3x, if you make that shift and your chain in the back is in an extreme position, you're at a greater likelihood for a drop chain.
Yep. And I had DI2 on my TT bike. There have been two races where, so I have DI2, I had like the shop tune it, that the chain fell out. And this isn't one happened where I was just in like 5311 or 5411. I forget what my front chain ring is, but I was just going downhill and it just came off the front. I didn't even shift. That happened a few times during a race, and I lost that race by the margin of which I stopped on the side of the road just to my friend. I mean, there's 2,000 people in the race, but I'm just racing my friend, right?
Right.
So now I have gone to it where I have chain catchers and chain guides. I just bought one for my cyclocross bike on all my bikes.
Yeah.
Why not? It's so small.
Yeah. If you can maintain the presence of mind to remember where your chain is on your cog set, that's really what it's all about. Because you don't ditch it on the back. You always ditch it on the front, on the chain rings. So if it's centered, chances are it's going to stay on. But if it's at either of those extremes, there's a really big chance you'll
pedaling.
Speak to Nate's issue, I wonder if this is a DI2 issue. I mean, we see a lot of top guys. Cancellara, we just mentioned him earlier. He refused to ride on DI2. Cavendish, a lot of the time, rides on mechanical as well. A lot of guys do that. And when I did my Everesting ride, that was 222 miles. That was the first time I've ridden DI2 for more than just around a parking lot. I dropped four chains. And that wasn't because, and one of them just dropped randomly. I was pedaling and it was gone and it fell off toward my pedals, right? Mm-hmm. Off of the big ring.
That's what happened to me.
And I dropped those chains not because I was in an extreme gear. So I don't know if it's a glitch or something that happens with DI2 or what.
If you're not shifting, DI2 should have nothing to do with it because you could take DI2 off unless the rear derailleur was doing something. I think it was maybe I had a bent front chain ring or something. Since then I've replaced the chain ring, the cassette, and the chain because I'm so upset about.
The one thing is DI2, a lot of when you shift with the front derailleur, it shifts the derailleur to an extreme position to actually make the shift happen, and then it pops back.
Brings it back. Yeah.
And I've heard, at least what people say, and I wasn't paying attention when this happened, that sometimes it just stays out in that extreme position, and that's why it drops earlier.
I had a duathlon here
that could
locally
be totally wrong. So,
and it was a small race, like 50 people, but this is the first race where I was in front of the entire race, and I was, you know, they were doing laps on Alexander Lake Road. You guys know where that one is?
Anyways. No one listening does.
Yeah, it's probably Rattlesnake Mountain. Anyways, a couple people do. I was way far ahead, almost a whole lap ahead of people.
Yeah.
And there's a big U-turn. You go from really fast down, you got to go climb back up. And my chain dropped so hard while I was pedaling that it got stuck between my frame and my cranks. And I had to abandon the race, take my cranks off to get it out.
That's like bad luck Brian stuff right there.
It's
a bad day.
I'm telling you. And on my cross bike and on my one bike, I've had to drop chain that and cross Reno. So chain guides and chain catchers everywhere for me. Hmm. It's not worth it. I spend all this time training and then I lose minutes or out of the race because of a drop chain.
Yeah, nobody likes to lose to a mechanical.
Look at the majority of the top XC guys and cyclocross guys. They're running a one by drivetrain, especially if they're running a Shimano one by drivetrain. They have a chain guide or chain catcher.
It's grams, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
I don't think there's a significant aero penalty.
No weight penalty.
No, not at all. Gavin's question. He says, Firstly, congrats on a great podcast. I'm an avid listener.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin. My question relates to position on the bike while training. I'm a triathlete starting my third season as a trainer road user. Previously, my usual course of action at this time of year, as the off season ends, was to grunt out an FTP test whereby I put out max watts, and untimely, I end up sacrificing the aero position that I perhaps should be holding.
Ultimately,
I assume, yeah. Thanks, autocorrect. So this year, I sacrificed the max watts position and stayed in my bars for the 20-minute test period. And that's during the 20-minute FTP test that we have. And my intention is to maintain this setup as best as I can for all sessions and intervals and future FTP tests. The reason I ask this question is because I find it pretty tough mentally to hold this position on the trainer, and I wonder to myself if the pros of working at less watts in the aero position outweighs working at higher watts in an upright position. Is the benefit to do so substantial, or am I looking at marginal gains? I'm interested to hear you discuss this topic. And if the benefits of maintaining the aero position are worth the pain. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, it's probably a good time to revisit it. We haven't talked about it in quite some time, but this is basically adapting to your aero position. If you try to adopt that aero position from the onset, you're missing a lot of the physiological cost or potentially the benefit of the workout. So you're not pushing your system to a point at which it can actually perform. and you're allowing your position to limit that. So my take on this is the same as it always been as always been, in that we do the lower intensity stuff in the aero position, the higher intensity stuff out of the aero position, and then over time you bring those two more closely in line. So you start doing, you know, maybe, you know, the 100 or threshold efforts, more of them in your aero position. In any case, it's a process. Test to your full capabilities. Do that in the position that allows you to eke out the most watts so you can see what your body can do. Then adapt your position so that you can express most of that capability. Power is absolutely king here. The positioning, I don't think I've come across a single athlete who balanced things more towards the aero side and that made up for putting out less power. It just doesn't typically work that way.
Right. It's something that you gradually, you get your FTP set and then you gradually work your position into it as your training
you
goes.
You might, like, during a 10-minute threshold effort, start with like a minute in aero and then kind of work in more as you're trying to get them closer.
These drills, the ones that have the on-screen instructions, and I'm sorry that all of them don't. I'm working on that all the time. Basically tell you to do that. You know, what's tolerable now is going to be a far cry from what's tolerable after 3 or 4 months of training, or 3 or 4 weeks even.
Yeah. Ideally, it's kind of a smooth gradient that increases so that by the time you reach your goal event, you've been slowly working that in so that come race day,
condition your body first and then over time adapt to that position, but don't try to jump right into that position at the expense of, you know, improved performance or improved fitness.
This brings up another topic, that some people are just too darn aggressive in their position.
Absolutely. That's such a big deal. They think, you know, if I can get my head down just a little bit lower, I'm going to be that much faster. First off, it's not as big a deal. It doesn't make as big a deal as you think it does. And the power you're sacrificing does. It makes quite a big deal.
And if you're listening and thinking, like, I've seen that guy, we should all take a moment to reflect on ourselves. Maybe we're that guy, because we saw a lot of people at Kona with positions that were...
I've made the mistake myself.
And these are high-performing athletes. And one, you know, maybe perhaps it was wind tunnel tested, and I don't know. But looking at it from the outside in, it looked very...
The eyeball wind tunnel.
For too long, I pursued that aggressive aero position, thinking it's going to make me faster.
Just last year you were playing with
it's free power, you know? I don't have to work as hard, and I'm going to go as fast. It never panned out.
You never went faster, yeah.
No.
We have a whole blog post on this, too.
And I would look at the power file at the end of it, and it's like, man, I know I'm stronger than that. So. Yeah. So you just have to...
So I guess the test it, I mean, to be scientific about it, if you look up Lar Chung method, he has like an outdoor wind tunnel thing you can use with the power meter if you have a no wind area. Wind tunnel, obviously that helps. I know looking at other people's wind tunnel results that going lower sometimes was less aero.
Mm-hmm. Like that's another thing.
Before they got to a certain point, so you could actually be less aero being lower. And then
consider how long you have to hold that position and what's going to happen as you start to break down. So you know, in my case, I'm more aero and I look better, but over time that position gets to be so painful that I'm coming up, and soon I'm not even in that aero position anymore, and my power's still not there.
That's happened to me on Ironman. Is after like 4 hours, I'm like sitting up all the time, and stretching, and
you're just slowing it down.
Yeah, I'm talking in the context of a 40K TT. So if you're a long course triathlete or ultra distance, much, much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm. Hannah's question, she says, hi there, I'm a female runner and a new cyclist and wanted to do a training base program during the winter. Base program during the winter while I do my base plan for running. I picked your sprint triathlon base plan since I figured this was made for cyclists who run as well. I don't do the swim part, she mentions. I'm in the second week now, and I'm struggling to keep the power as per the plan. I do the trainer road, so she does her trainer road workout first thing in the morning in a fasted state. However, my resting heart rate has now slowly increased to about 20 more beats per minute. Is this normal? Shall I keep going and power through, or am I doing something wrong?
My guess is that you're training one way. You mentioned you're doing the MAF method, which is a max aerobic function method, which is a low intensity approach with your running, and then you're doing the intervals on the bike. I'm guessing that you're just a little beat up, that you're trying to combine too much work and it's taking a toll on your body in general, and you're having to push a higher heart rate to achieve the powers that you're targeting. So,
well, it said a resting heart rate is 20 beats more.
Correct.
Resting.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah,
that's a big sign that you're over, that you need to rest a little bit.
I thought that was your working heart rate. Resting, that's a definite red flag that you're pushing too hard, doing too much.
Granted, that's also assuming that the heart rate, that it's accurate what she's measuring with, which we've touched on this plenty of times. We have a blog post about it and everything else. It's pretty variable a lot of the times measuring with that. But I looked, it looks like you jumped into the mid-volume plan, and you mentioned that you're pretty new. So that mid-volume plan, perhaps consider dropping down to the low volume. That could be something that, and then measure the change that happens.
Yep.
That might be a good option for you.
Yeah, in all cases, it may not seem like it, but the goal really is to do as little work as possible for the greatest benefit. And you might find that...
That's my life.
That should be most people's life. Unless you're a professional athlete, that should be your life.
Yeah.
Just in all things.
In all things, yeah.
Well, our common recommendation is to, when in doubt, always start with the lower volume plan.
Yeah.
In your case, that would be the low volume plan, and then go from there. You can always add on, but it's really hard to backtrack. It's really hard to dig yourself out of that hole and just knock off a couple workouts and then just somehow right that ship. It doesn't really happen like that.
Yeah. You can drop down to low, give yourself some time to measure what it's like and let us know how it works. Simon's question, hey, all, absolutely love the podcast. Keep up the great work. You could make a drinking game based on how often Nate mentions his height or weight. It makes me laugh every time.
Speaking of that, yesterday,
I
hit a new low weight record, which is 178, which
drink
at 6'6", if you guys didn't know.
Drink again.
That's pretty light. So my sister at Thanksgiving said that it sounds like I have a complex. But I don't think I have a complex, guys.
And I told Nate that you do have a complex. It's called you're a cyclist. So we all have those.
Still got some fat,
Nate's
though.
Just more verbal about his obsession.
Yeah, exactly. So to the question, could a lack of VO2 work affect my performance in the base season? I did a lot of 3-minute VO2 intervals during race season, and this boosted my FTP to 302 on the 2x8-minute test. I had a week off entirely, then went straight into the new season. But since stopping the VO2 work from earlier in the year to focus on base, I've gradually felt a decline in fitness. And notice he says felt a decline in fitness. And have been struggling with the sweet spot base workload. I was regularly doing 600 TSS weeks, but now I struggle to do 400 TSS when so much of the work is muscular endurance. Any thoughts? Do I just need to muscle on through?
There's kind of a lot of things going on here. I never, except for maybe the traditional base plans, get very far from VO2 work because I don't want to see this decrement. It's unnecessary because it takes so little to maintain it. On top of that, you're doing a lot of muscular endurance work, which is really physiologically taxing. So, you can look at your TSS, which is your stress, right? But you also have to consider the strain, so the overall load that it takes on your body, what it does to your hormone levels, your cortisol levels, all these things that you don't necessarily see when you're just tracking TSS. I mean, it runs your body down, which is why I kind of try to counterbalance some of that muscular endurance work with shorter, more intense stuff that's really productive, but and is still physiologically very taxing, but you don't do all that much of it. So basically, I would never stray too far from that VO2 max work. And you'll notice that's, like I said, that's what the plans do. They never let you get too far from it because it's easy to maintain it. And then when you start to really focus on it, you're already starting from that high spot and you can build it that much more rapidly rather than having to start from scratch and rebuild it before you can actually elevate it.
So it sounds like it. So in this case, he's dropped, or I should say he's following sweet spot base. So he's doing less VO2 work than he was, mm-hmm. right? And he notices that it's tougher for him to do the sustained stuff that he mentions there. That's, for me, totally normal. I feel that every time. And it's kind of like in golf, if you any of the pros, they ebb and flow between times when they're great off the tee and then mm-hmm. their short game is just on fire. And it's rare for them to have both of them going great at the same time. It's pretty rare.
That's a tough balance.
Yeah. And with cycling, it's kind of similar in the sense that, you'll feel great when you're doing a lot of that VO2 work at that type of effort. And then once, if you're doing a lot of sustained work, you'll feel great at that effort too.
This sounds like me right now, Simon. I'm going into the taper now. We have taper week for our cross stuff in 2 weeks. And I think I'm going to do 4 races in 2 weeks. It'll be really fun. But I did a couple sweet spot base workouts for that extra week that I didn't plan correctly for. And I was surprised about how hard those were compared to the VO2 max. I am outstanding at VO2 max now. Mm-hmm. So when I come back into it, I don't think I'm actually going to raise my FTP and just, as Chad kind of says, solidify my FTP.
Yeah, consolidate.
Yeah. At 310 and then for the first six weeks and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, and veering back and forth like that can prove to be tremendously effective. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice variety of stimuli, too. I mean, you're shocking your system in one way, and before it really adapts and plateaus to it, well, the plateaus, you're shocking it in another way, and you're kind of managing the... using one to elevate the other. I mean, they both work as a unit. They work together.
So to directly answer your question, Simon, yep, just muscle on through with what you're doing. You're doing the right thing with the plan. It'll feel tough for a bit, but you'll adapt. And then in the latter half of sweet spot base, things get closer to VO2.
In any case, you're not going to be doing one thing for all that long. Even with sweet spot base, the first 6 weeks are focused predominantly on sweet spot. But then once you get into the second half of that plan, you start seeing more, you know, over-unders and VO2 max work and even some little sprint type efforts and stuff, but it'll start to vary itself a little more than that initial 6 weeks does.
It's also, how do I say this? Kind of deceiving. VO2 work can be deceiving and trick you into thinking that if you think about when you're doing VO2 stuff, if you're outside, you're moving fast. It's when you're climbing. It's when you're doing that type of thing. But when you really have your sustained power down, it's not as flashy in terms of making you like that faster rider, but it totally is effective. It helps you carry that speed throughout the day on the course, whatever it may be. So
yeah, I think of VO2 max work as basically improving your capacity for work. And then when you start to do the muscle endurance work, you're improving your duration, how long you can sustain high percentages of that capacity.
Another way, when I think about this, when you go back to sweet spot base, is that we're like our foundation now, we're laying like another 12 inches on the foundation of our base. Yep. So next time this year, when you're doing your VO2 max work for maybe end of race season, it's going to be even higher.
Yeah. Season to season, year to year, that base should come up a little bit, ideally.
Yep. But it doesn't, you're not going to be peak fitness year round. You know what I mean?
Right. You have to be okay with it ebbing and flowing. That's normal. Yeah.
It's a hard pill to swallow, but your fitness does decline at times and you just have to be okay with that.
Yep. Absolutely. Phil says, gents, great podcast. He called us gentlemen. I like that. Great podcast. I can't thank you enough for getting me energized and motivated. I use the podcast while walking my 10,000 steps on my rest days. I'm also now hooked on bulletproof coffee and oatmeal.
Uh-oh.
So I guess that means
that
we basically, I keep thinking that we could be terrible people and take advantage of this and make a bulletproof coffee product or something.
I just prefer butter over cream. It doesn't have to be bulletproof coffee. We're not endorsing anybody's product.
Yeah.
I like oatmeal.
Yeah. Oatmeal's great.
Yeah. I have Quaker oatmeal. Stock or Quaker oatmeal stock.
Yeah. Here's my question. I'm obese, or so say the measuring tools. I need to lose a cinder block, and I will over time, and not with crazy diets or tapeworms or lipo or anything stupid. I did a century ride last year with 4,800 feet of ascent. I finished in 7 hours, including stoppage time. I felt pretty good at the end, except some cramps, which one of your podcasts addressed, and I've now corrected. Good to hear, man. Maybe he's drinking sriracha, like you guys.
Jesus Musker.
Yeah. This coming year, I want to finish in 5.5 hours, including stoppage time. That A ride, and it's not a race, he indicates, is not until July 23rd, so I have plenty of time. My FTP is currently 228. I finished traditional base high volume. That's the other base plan option that we have. I finished traditional base high volume 1 on Sunday. Understanding my high fat percentage and higher than average weight, should I repeat a few sections of the section 2 and 3 of traditional base? Because there are 3 cumulative parts to it. I did read on one of the blog posts this was good for fat loss. Or is it most advantageous to finish the high volume plans on schedule and then repeat a few weeks in sustained power build and then repeat a few weeks again in the century specialty plan?
Do you want me to answer this one?
Sure, chime in. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know if you guys know, but I have lost some weight.
Oh, gosh. Drink again. Y'all are getting hammered right now.
No, but really, so I think you should just skip traditional base and move right into sweet spot base and then go into sustained power build and then into century. Your FTP at 228 is low enough that what you want to do is get that up and you're going to burn more calories per workout. And then, so don't be so concerned about losing weight because you're doing traditional base and it's going to burn a higher percentage of fat because it's lower intensity. You're going to want to change your body. And to do that, the number one way, or like the only way I personally think, I might get hate mail, but is to consume less calories than you burn. So you're going to have to eat less. We've talked about this a lot. Fuel for your workouts, but then your other 2 meals, don't fuel for them. I mean, don't fuel, like don't eat a lot and try to go to bed hungry every night. That is huge for me. Whenever I go to bed hungry, I lose a little bit more all the time.
Something that people misunderstand with the low intensity, big duration part is the emphasis on big duration. To really get it to burn that amount of fat that you want, you have to put in a lot of time at that low intensity, and you may be able to burn more calories effectively and fat from that. From sweet spot work, right, Chad?
Yeah, honestly, it really starts with your diet. So, and that's such a huge topic, we can't really delve into it too deeply. But both approaches work. It's a question of how you want to go about it. You know, what's your you can go either way. We're obviously proponents of getting it done a little bit quicker. If you've got the time and you're willing to, you know, gut it out and just metabolize basically fat, very little sugar ingestion, if any, while you're riding, that can be tremendously effective for fat loss. It's just a time-consuming approach. Mm-hmm. And it's not one that builds particularly high levels of performance. It does once we start to sprinkle in the stuff that, you know, breathes in some of that intensity. But it's just a longer, slower, more patient approach. If you have the time for it, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just most people that we deal with and ourselves, we don't have the time for it, so we try to maximize it.
Yeah. To be clear, too, this traditional base plan wasn't built to be a fat-burning plan, right? That's not the intent. So, and neither was the sweet spot base one. They're not built specifically just to burn fat. In both cases,
we're looking to improve aerobic fitness. Yeah. Both of these do it. They just do it in different manners, different effects on the body. Overall, this pretty much the same effect.
Right. Yeah. So if you're really looking to use that low and that low long approach, if you're really looking for that, then, or to lose fat with that, then you, would it be fair to say that you might have to tack on even more time to that, Chad?
Not necessarily. I think it just, again, comes back to diet. I mean, if you're doing the lower intensity stuff, you don't need a whole lot of food. You can keep the caloric intake down. You can keep the fat metabolism up.
Phil, you said that you are obese. So I'm going to say, he's got weight to lose. And if you're obese right now, like, don't eat so much food. I mean, that sounds bad, but I just did some math here. If on just a 350 calorie deficit per day, you do that for every day for 12 weeks, that's 8.4 pounds of fat. That's very maintainable, 350. If you're obese, you can probably go a little bit more. But something that people don't realize, look at kind of some of the foods you're eating. 350 calories isn't that much.
It's not.
Like one scoop of ice cream, 350 calories. A lot of Chad's beers, way more than 350 calories, right? And that's just that per day. A Big Mac without cheese, I think, is around 350.
It's around that.
Yeah. But just that little bit less every day, 8 pounds of fat. And that brings me to my next point. Is you two guys, we need to DEXA again. I know you're both scared of it.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, Monday.
Because I've been slacking hard.
I felt that's why it'll be good, though. It's okay.
I felt lean in the mirror this morning. I felt lean.
Me too.
Pinch tats felt lean.
I know. That's why I want to do DEXA right now. But I mean, it's so no one would body shame you, Chad, besides Jonathan and I.
Yeah.
If you gained some fat since last time.
Oh, yeah. I'm not worried about that.
Yeah. Okay. No. So anyways, we should do it just to, because I think I have not been in the weight loss mode. Have you been in weight loss mode?
Nope.
You, Chad?
Not at all.
Yeah. So it'd be very interesting for everyone to see what it was like with us just kind of maintaining and not being too strict.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
But in general, I would focus mostly on eating less and getting your weight down. If this should just be a goal in life, because of all the health stuff we talk about, nutrition, there is proof that obesity causes cancers and heart problems. Yeah.
And Nate's more of the calories in, calories out sort of approach. I'm more in the approach where you cultivate a particular metabolism with what you ingest, you know, what you eat. If you eat a high sugar diet, you're going to burn a lot of sugar. Your body's going to get used to burning a lot of sugar. If you keep the intensity low and therefore all you need is to ingest fat, burn fat, it cultivates a different insulin response, a different, just a different metabolism in a general sense.
I think both can complement each other.
There's middle ground.
Yep, certainly.
I'm not you guys are misrepresenting me. Calories in, calories out, yes. But when losing weight, I'm still not eating any sugar either because it's so much easy to eat a lot of sugar and,
I think what I'm saying is
easy calories. You don't get full.
It's more than the calories in, calories out approach, more than the 350 calorie deficit. Focus more on what you're putting in your body. The more sugar you put in, the more your system basically just gets used to metabolizing sugar. It's a whole different ball of wax.
We will agree to disagree. Is that a good place to end?
I think we'll end on that note.
Okay.
So if you want to submit more questions to us, please do. We get plenty of them. We comb through them and try to find the best ones that we can for each episode, or ones that provide for the most entertainment, because you don't want to bore you guys when you're listening to us. So no need to lie and make it extra entertaining, but keep it topical. Cycling and triathlon related questions, do so at trainerroad.com/podcast, or use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. You can find us on Snapchat at TrainerRoad, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.